The question I always get, for those of you who attended some of the other ones, is can you really do anything in South Sudan after nearly 30 years of warfare and the health system is completely destroyed? As Carlos Cuellar, a longtime friend, said to me, the issue is not health sector reform there. The issue is health sector forming, getting it together in a way that it functions. Those of you who know MSH know that we have a lot of experience in fragile states. I myself lived 3 years in Afghanistan. I've helped support South Sudan, worked in the DRC. And I can tell you what I'm about to talk now is a central technical approach to all three of those countries. It's performance-based contracting for primary health care. The Sudan Health Transformation Project ended about a year ago. We worked in 14 counties across all 10 states. The original idea of the project, which was funded by USAID, is to set up centers of excellence in each state that they could learn from. The population is not very large. It's only about 1.4 million. But the total population is not very high either. South Sudan is a huge country, mostly swampy, and the population is dispersed in rural villages. As you can see, that we did have a fairly significant population of both women and children, and we worked in 163 different health facilities. Our overall goal was to help decentralize the health service, improve the health status. We had three intermediate results, which is expanding access, increasing knowledge and demand, and especially the capacity of the Republic of South Sudan to deliver and manage services. We had three key indicators that were followed very closely, plus about another 15 other indicators for a total of 18. And this is important because each indicator has specific targets that need to be met by county, by quarter, and by year. These are the components of the basic package of health and nutrition services. They borrowed this concept from Afghanistan. When we worked in Afghanistan, we worked very hard to help the country to define the basic package of health services. And Liberia and the DRC also follows a similar pattern. Again, you can see some common threads throughout all the post-conflict fragile states. So we worked on child health, nutrition, malaria, water and sanitation, and maternal and reproductive health, and infectious disease control, especially a rising rate of HIV. We elected to use a performance-based financing approach. The government of South Sudan, actually now the Republic of South Sudan, because it became an independent republic during the lifetime of this project, has elected to contract services out. Again, Afghanistan, Haiti have done this as well. Basically, the process is to select a subcontracting partner in each of the 14 counties. Nine NGOs participated in the process, most of them international NGOs that were too local. The problem was for decades with all the NGOs in the country, each NGO did everything that they knew how to do, but it was usually quite different in each area for each NGO. So part of our charge, if you will, was to standardize approaches, training, reactivate community-based healthcare. We also implemented the Leadership Development Program and quality improvement, as well as monitoring and evaluation. These were all standardized across all the counties to begin forming, as we spoke earlier, a Ministry of Health and standardized approaches. The maternal mortality, probably still is, one of the highest in the world, at 2,054. Now, I did make reference in the previous discussion, when we started in Afghanistan, it was very similar. In 2002, the maternal mortality ratio was 1,850. And in the Afghanistan mortality study, which was completed in 2011 and the results released late last year, it's now around 356. So we were able to compress into a little bit less than 10 years a significant reduction in maternal mortality, which normally takes a lot longer and a lot of economic development to occur. We from MSH, who have worked in both Afghanistan and now South Sudan, would submit that performance-based contracting is an essential approach to compress the time period to achieve significant reductions in mortality. You can also see DPT-3 immunization and the contraceptive prevalence rate were very low. Now, performance-based contracting requires a clear definition of objectives, indicators, and targets. And we work very closely. Did the mic just go off? Can you hear me? No? Okay. Maybe I should shout, huh? I seem to bring technological problems with me wherever I go. I've long known that I have electronic gremlins under my fingernails. Okay, it's on? Good. Okay. In any event, my computer acts up on its own, and so I'm not surprised this machinery here does the same thing. So what we try to do, as I mentioned, with the basic package of health services, is direct the flow of resources to the high-impact health services, the ones that we know. We don't have to prove that these reduce mortality, these services, that there's just a body of knowledge out there that has done that. So what we do is we define clearly for each county what the targets are, what the indicators, what some of the processes that need to be done in terms of what I talked about, training, mentorship, quality assurance, and the like. We issue a call for proposals. There's a workshop to explain to all the potential bidders what the process is. They submit a proposal. And for each county, there are anywhere from 2 to 5 proposals submitted. We have to review and select. The Ministry of Health was very much involved in that process, so it was a combination of MSH and Ministry of Health people who selected the potential awardee for the county. You then have to do a survey to make sure that the organization can fulfill the requirements, has the technical and financial capability, and then you negotiate the targets. This turned out to be very time-consuming, and it's something we ultimately dropped. Because, of course, if you're going to be paid for performance against targets, the subcontracting partner is going to want the target as low as possible. And I used to, in our quarterly meetings, I would say, who here would like to increase their targets? Raise your hand. Nobody would. I said, who here would like to lower your targets? Everybody raises their hand. I said, okay, now get this. We have set targets for the whole project that we're responsible to USAID. So if we reduce your targets, we have to increase your targets. Are you willing to do that? And they said, no, I'm not willing to increase my target. Okay, then let's just accept that we're going to divide the targets up by population as the fairest way of apportioning targets to each subcontracting partner, and that's what we did for the rest of the project. This initial negotiation of targets just proved to be way too time-consuming, too much of a hassle, and really was, I think, counterproductive because it set up an adversary approach, and that's not what performance-based contracting is about. Performance-based contracting is agreeing to work together to not only achieve targets, but overachieve, and everybody does well because you can get paid a bonus, and that's the incentive. We had two types of incentives, which I'll show you in a bit. One is if you overachieve targets, you got a 6% bonus, And if you underachieved your targets, you got penalized by 10%. By you, I mean the subcontracting partner. So ultimately, we ended up with 14 subcontracts, one in each county, through 9 different subcontracting partners, obviously. Several of them had more than one. When we first started, I was actually not involved at this point. We had 18 indicators. The payment was based on achieving all 18 indicators. So no surprise that nobody got a bonus of any type, because that was way too complex. Based on my experience in Afghanistan, when I came on the project, we developed what I call an NGO scorecard, a much reduced number of indicators that include the key indicators, and we added some management indicators, like submitting your financial reports on time, submitting your quarterly HMIS reports, because it was a big hassle for us to keep tracking who's reported when, so we just decided to tie that into payment. So that if you achieved over 100% of your targets total for the quarter, the SCP, the subcontracting partner, got a 6% bonus, and they could use that however they want it. Most of them used it to improve the project. Many of them used it to top off salaries of healthcare workers. But if you only scored 95% of your target assignment for the county, if you only scored 80%, you got penalized. If you scored between 80 and 95, then you got everything that was coming to you. Now, we selected the indicators to support the National Health Strategy. We weighted the indicators because, as I noted, 3 key indicators were more important than the others, so we gave them a higher weight. And then we set a cap for each indicator. In other words, you couldn't overachieve too much on an indicator. And that's an example on the bottom of the indicators that were selected. It included our key indicators and as well as those that focused on maternal and child health. Now, you're going to be tested on this at the end, so I want you to study this in detail. I'm aware that you can't see the numbers, but this is, in fact, a quarterly invoice, an actual quarterly invoice from a subcontracting partner. You can see on the left are listed the 11 programmatic indicators. 8 are technical, 3 are management. I want to point out one indicator which we added, and it's in red right here, and I'll read it to you. It's percent of health facilities receiving a documented supervisory visit during the quarter. Now, it's interesting. What we found is that some of the SCPs figured out they could score over 100% just going to 2 or 3 facilities, the larger ones in urban areas, and they were neglecting some of the rural ones. Some of the rural facilities, when our staff went out, hadn't had a supervisor visit in 6 months. So the beauty of the performance-based contracting is we made that an indicator. We sort of retrofitted it and said, your score is supposed to be 100 for that. You need to visit 100% of your assigned facilities every quarter. And if you don't, that's going to reduce your score. And so what you end up with here are the weights. The weighted ones are, as you can see, if you can read it, a little higher than the other ones. And you end up with a score, in this case, 83%. So the SCP gets 100% of its allotment that quarter, okay? Now, I want to show you just a few indicators. And I want to point out that introducing this performance-based formula was a process that began back here with the announcement and the training of the SCPs on how we were going to calculate payment. So what's very interesting to me, this being one of our key indicators, DPT-3, to note that the quarter before the PVC was introduced, which was when we trained them, all of a sudden you see an uptick, okay? And I just find that fascinating, that once we announced we were going to do this, whatever the subcontracting partners did, they improved their performance. Same thing for the number of women with four more ANC visits. You can see that the improvement started the quarter before we actually implemented it. Now, not all had that dramatic change. You can see that IPT2 actually stayed sort of flat, but then increased immediately thereafter. And number of counseling visits per quarter just seemed to skyrocket whether after we introduced the PBC. Now, obviously, you have to verify the results, so data quality analysis was really important. We did have a couple of teams which would go out to do it. We trained the subcontracting partners to do it themselves, but they really didn't. The county health departments, which are supposed to keep track of data quality, usually are supposed to have 12 to 15 people. Most of them average maybe three, and they couldn't do it themselves. And we would adjust payments if we found discrepancies. But it's interesting to note, the first quarter we introduced this, there was no bonus at all paid out. By the second quarter, there were two bonuses. And each quarter thereafter, over half of the counties got an extra 6% payment. They really figured out how to do it. They figured out what they had to do to get out there and get the services going. And this even included introducing a new indicator, which was the percent of facilities visited. So, I mean, you can really see over time the growth of their capacity to deliver services. We did have a penalty. If you scored less than 80%, we took money away from you. And in the first quarter, there were two penalties assessed. But after that, no negative penalties at all. In other words, they figured out, and word got out, that a couple of them lost money. So everybody said, we don't want that to happen. Let's make sure we get out there and do our jobs. And then, interestingly enough, in the last quarter, we eliminated the negative incentive. And the reason was we got an extension until the new projects came online, and we had to renegotiate extensions of all the subcontracts. One subcontractor refused to accept the negative incentive, and rather than hold it up, we had a choice to cancel their contract and take it over ourselves or just accept their position. If we did it for them, we had to do it for everybody. So we eliminated the negative incentive. And what I consider a natural experiment, four of the SCPs would have received a penalty payment in the last quarter. In other words, once we eliminated the negative incentive, they just sort of fell off. And it was the end of the project. You know, there were transitions, probably people leaving. But I look upon that as a natural experiment validating the point that you need both positive incentives and negative incentives. Not everybody agrees with that, but and based on our experience, I think the data is very clear. So one of the questions worth asking is what would have happened without the PBF intervention? My own sense is, as I said, we were able to compress in 2 years what would have taken 3 or 4 years. By the way, there's a body of literature out there. This is not a research project, but there have been research projects done in Haiti and Rwanda, both countries in which we've introduced PBCs, that does show a PBC intervention area achieves targets much more rapidly than one that does not have a PBC. And are other non-incentivized indicators jeopardized? I think that's a good question. We didn't study that at all. And then the next big step would be government contracting in. And the government was very interested in that. And this basically is you take the government budget that goes to the state, Ministry of Health, and from state to the county, and you incentivize those budgets much the same way we've done here. So what have we learned? Well, for sure, the performance-based contracts do work in fragile states post-conflict. They accelerated performance. We believe improved access. We believe this strategy, which was nationwide in Afghanistan, helped dramatically reduce maternal and infant mortality in a 10-year period. We believe it could happen in South Sudan. The negative incentives are very important. The data quality insurance is vital. but the government did not have the capacity to manage the process. So if they are going to move along with contracting in, they're going to need continuous support. So thank you very much for your attention. Hopefully you've learned a bit about how PBCs can work in a fragile state and compress the time needed to achieve significant gains of life-saving interventions. Thank you very much. Can we stay up here for questions?